And so we come to think for a while about the story of Thomas and its implication for us as individuals and as a church. I grew up, as many of you know, in a South Wales Valleys village, went to the local church, and at the beginning of every service, the church secretary, who was a very powerful and daunting individual, would give notices. And as part of giving the notices, would always introduce who the minister for the day was. It didn't matter that it was the minister of the church who was there 48 weeks of the year. He still insisted on announcing who the minister was with a great flourish. And not only did he announce who the minister was, he was insistent on including that person's academic qualifications. And back in the day, in order to prepare for ministry within Baptist churches, particularly in Wales, one was expected to do a general degree, for which one got a BA, and then subsequent to that, one would do a theological qualification, for which one would get a BD. So for nearly every Sunday of the year, the church secretary would launch into, and our preacher for today is the Reverend Emlyn Stevens, BA, BD. With some wit later on adduced to mean born again but doubtful. So whenever a minister came along to preach who had the qualifications BA, BD, it was assumed he was someone who'd been born again but was doubtful. Thankfully, I have an MA, BD. So maybe doubtful, but perhaps not born again. That's a different issue altogether. Thomas has been done to death as far as sermons are concerned. I don't think there's a new word to be said about Thomas. I feel sorry for him, really. He's been pulled apart, put back together, and then pulled apart again. Was he really doubting Thomas? Was he Thomas the twin? What was it about him? Is he deserving of our criticism? Is he deserving of our praise? Is there anything good we can say about him? Or should we all be like him? All of these questions have been addressed ad nauseam from the pulpit. But notwithstanding that, I'm going to have my two penneth. I don't think for a moment that Thomas doubted. I think it's wrong to describe him as doubting Thomas. He just wanted to be sure for himself. And I think there's a world of difference between having doubts and just wanting to be sure for oneself. Because on the face of it, why should he believe what others told him? He wanted to see what the others had seen, to hear what the others had heard. He wanted to touch the hands. He wanted to be sure for himself. Now, of course, he was in a unique situation. He was able to see for himself. And as far as the life of faith is concerned, we don't enjoy that unique privilege. We are not able to see for ourselves. But we can believe for ourselves. The Christian faith, the Christian life, is not a way of being that can be imposed upon one person by another. Christian faith, the Christian way of living, is not one that can be imposed upon one person by another. Christianity is not a tick box religion. Of course, it's the duty of every Christian to seek to introduce the Christian faith to others by every means possible. Yes, we should. And one of the most powerful ways in which we can introduce the Christian faith to others is to tell our own stories, to give our testimony, to tell others why it was that we became a Christian, why it is we are a Christian, what it means for us to be a Christian, and so on. And all of us should take every opportunity to do that. But in the end, each person has to believe for themselves. Each person has to believe what they believe on account of having considered the claims which God makes upon their life in and through the person of Jesus. And of course, as we journey through life, what we believed once upon a time, we may well no longer believe in the precise same way. We may believe now what we believed then, but differently. David Cameron was once asked about his Christian faith, and he made the remark, which I thought was actually quite powerful. He said, "It's a bit like radio reception in the Chilterns. It fades in and out." Now, I don't pay much attention to much else that he's ever said, and certainly won't be buying his book, but that's another issue altogether. But I thought that was quite an insightful comment. Christian faith is a bit like radio reception in the Chilterns. It fades in and out. I think there's a lot of truth in that. And we should be wary of being critical of such comments, because it sums up what it's like for a lot of us. Fading in and fading out, depending on the way life's circumstances change. Toward the end of that most famous chapter, 1 Corinthians 13, the hymn to love that we talk about, Paul says, "While I was a child, I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child. I understood life as a child. When I grew up, I put away childish things." When I grew up, I put away childish things. There's a sense in which faith needs to mature. It needs to be tested and affirmed in the light of testing. As Christians, we have to grow up. The world needs mature Christianity. It needs evidence of Christians who've grown up in the faith. Yes, still childlike, but certainly not childish. Putting away childish things to live a childlike life in a mature way, what I've described before as adult children of God. That's what we need to be, adult children of God. And that will test our faith and our understanding of it, and so on. The old certainties are very easily swept away on the flood tide of experience. It was a while ago now, and it dates me to refer to it, but the BBC commissioned a series facilitated by the Cambridge academic Don Cupid entitled The Sea of Faith. And I found that sufficiently intriguing to write a doctoral thesis on it. And if you'd like to borrow it, if you're having trouble sleeping, I can lend it to you, and you can read it. And Cupid's thesis, in a sense, was to take the insights of the 19th century and the Enlightenment and so on, and see how that has reshaped an understanding of Christianity into the 21st century. The phrase, "the sea of faith," is taken from Matthew Arnold's poem on Dover Beach. And it's worth reminding ourselves of the context in which Arnold wrote those words, because it's very easy to pluck a phrase out of obscurity and create it into a headline without properly understanding why it was written in the way it was in the first place. So Matthew Arnold wrote this: "The sea of faith was once too at the full, and round earth's shore lay like the folds of a bright girdle furled. But now I only hear its melancholy long withdrawing roar, retreating to the breath of the night wind down the vast edges, drear and naked shingles of the world." our love. Let us be true to one another. For the world, which seems to lie before us like a land of dreams, so various, so beautiful, so new, hath really neither joy, nor love, nor light, nor certitude, nor peace, nor help for pain. And we are here as on a darkling plain, swept with confused alarms of struggle and flight, where ignorant armies clash by night. Well, he sounds a cheerful soul, doesn't he? He's headmaster of rugby school. It must have been a funner day to be in school with him. But you get the sense of the problem he had. The certainties of faith with which he'd grown up were being swept away on this tide. The tide retreated, the sea of faith went out before him. And what was he left with? He was left with shingle. Nothing to believe at all. Now, I think he's made a crucial error there. And the crucial error is this. Tide both comes and goes. It may go out, but it'll come back in. And yes, there will be times when for us the sea of faith, as we might describe it, will retreat before us, and the world will seem bare and barren. But the tide will come back. And why shouldn't it? And why shouldn't faith return with even greater certainty than that which left us in our childlike years? So what do we make of poor old Thomas? Well, in truth, Thomas was being a faithful disciple of Jesus. He was being faithful to Jesus and to the teaching he'd received from Jesus, because on a previous occasion, Jesus had warned all of the disciples, including Thomas, that many will come in my name, saying, I am the Messiah, and they will lead you astray. So you need to be sure that it is from me, because others will come and claim to be who I am. Jesus affirms those who believe without seeing, precisely because such belief takes great faith and courage. Takes great faith and courage to believe in that which you cannot see. But don't ignore the evidence of your eyes when it is available, as if to do so makes us more faithful. Yes, there will be that in which we believe, but there will be plenty we can see with our own eyes. And if what we believe contradicts what we see with our own eyes, it's quite likely that what we believe is wrong. Not what we see with our eyes is in error. Fossils. Fossils. It's all about fossils. The Bible says the world was created in the year 4004 BC. The earth is 6,500 years old. And someone wanders along the Dorset coast and trips over a bit of rock and discovers in it a fossil. And there's a problem now, because this fossil seems to be rather older than 6,000 years. It seems to be actually many millions of years old. And so the head-scratching vicar says, I've got a difficulty. My Bible tells me the world is only 6,000 years old. This fossil tells me that the world must be at least millions of years old. Who is right? Now, of course, if you do a bit of sensible thinking, both can be right. You don't have to make a choice. But the evidence of your eyes encourages you to recast the structure of your faith. Because the alternative was, and this is where you begin to realize that the argument was lost before it started, God put fossils in the earth and made them appear to be millions of years old to test our faith. Because really they were only 6,000 years old like the rest of the earth, but God wanted to test you. Yeah, that was always going to fill the churches. The impulse to neglect the evidence of our eyes not only neglects God's command to love him with our minds, love the Lord your God with all your heart, your soul, your strength, and your mind, but can blind us to the deeper truth of Scripture. It's not about ticking off the years as if the Bible was a calendar. We must be honest with our uncertainties. We should never throw around doubt with rebellious defiance. Neither should we view genuine questions and uncertainties as liabilities. Questioning deeply held beliefs opens us up to discovering that maybe we were in error and offers us an opportunity for a more faithful understanding. Or we might find that our fears are unfounded and return to a former way of believing without doubt and now stronger for it. In Matthew's gospel, Matthew tells us that the disciples went out with Jesus toward the mountain where they would receive the Great Commission, subsequent to which he would ascend to heaven before their eyes. And in that lovely story, full of joy and celebration and euphoria, Matthew felt it necessary to include a short phrase, which is the one that we have on the front of the order of service. All of this joy and euphoria that surrounds the fact that they're with the risen Christ and celebrating the fact, and Matthew finds it necessary to slot in the short phrase, but some doubted. They still went, didn't stop them going, didn't prevent them from being there, didn't prevent them from being with their friends, didn't cause them to separate off. They still went. But Matthew felt it was sufficiently important a detail to include it. But some doubted. No gathering of Christians, no Sunday congregation is complete without some who doubt. Why? Because all of us have our doubts from time to time. Even the minister has his or her doubts. And you better believe that. Even the minister has his or her doubts. Only some of us mind. Not many, not a lot, but at least some. Don't imagine for a moment that there is anyone here this morning who has not entertained doubts concerning faith and its implications for living. There will be amongst us this morning the some who are doubting. It's okay. You can doubt. Confront it. Don't deny it. Every Christian congregation that's worth its salt will contain within it an element of the some who are doubting. The church cannot demand of anyone that they conform to a particular pattern of believing, that they sign up to any particular statement of faith. I'm not a great one for statements of faith. Neither is it for any one of us to judge another concerning what we may or may not believe about this, that, or the other. When we come together for worship, it's not so that under God we can be reminded by the so-called powers that be what to believe and how to live. And if that's why you come to church here, you're in the wrong place, because no one here is going to tell you what to believe or how to live. Because as it says on the brick on that far side of the church, God really is larger than the creeds. No, faith is about being held by God in love and service. Faith is about God letting ourselves be addressed by what God has to say to us. Faith can never be rigidly self-certain. The Christian faith, if it is to be anything at all, reminds us that we are called into a relationship with God and with the world and with each other, such that we are able to realize who we are under God. And so when we come together for worship, and when we explore together what it means to live the Christian life, we will have that sense of God so working amongst us that he will be dethroning any self-centered arrogance that is part of us. He will cause us to deny any self-defining certainty within which we've wrapped ourselves. He will defeat any self-imposed authority that we have dared lay claim to our lives other than He. Not to punish us, but to save us from the inevitable consequences that will befall us. Because the wages of sin is death. And you can read that on the line, between the lines, and under the line if you want to know what Paul meant when he wrote that. Got to finish with a quotation from the course, the arch nemesis of the church from the 19th century, good old Charles Darwin. And Darwin wrote this, and I think this is magnificent, concerning not God, but concerning us and our attitude to the world around us and to anything else in which we're engaged. They just experienced an earthquake. And in the aftermath of the earthquake, Darwin writes, "The earthquake, however, must be to everyone a most impressive event. The earth, considered from our earliest childhood as the type of solidity, has oscillated like a thin crust beneath our feet. And in seeing the labored works of man in a moment overthrown, we feel the insignificance of his boasted power." We feel the insignificance of his boasted power. Those who boast that they know for sure are not the ones to follow. Those who encourage us to doubt and to explore accordingly, he is the one who leads us on.